This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Will North Carolina be the next state to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment? Suffragists first introduced what became the ERA in 1923. The amendment would guarantee equal rights under the law, regardless of sex. Almost 50 years later, Congress passed the ERA, gave states until 1979 to ratify. Three-fourths of states would have to approve the amendment before it could be added to the Constitution. Only 35 states did, even with extended deadlines. But in 2017, the state of Nevada voted to approve the Equal Rights Amendment, and last year, Illinois followed suit. If one more state approves the amendment, it would meet the threshold and could become law. Senator Terry Van Dyne co-sponsored legislation last month for the North Carolina General Assembly to ratify the ERA. She's a Democratic state senator from District 49, which includes Buncombe County, and joins us now. Senator Van Dyne, welcome.
It's a privilege to be here.
Tell us why you co-sponsored this legislation to pass the ERA in North Carolina.
Well, the big issue for me is economic equality. What we know is that women on average make 80% what a man makes. And that means that they don't have the resources they need to feed their families, to buy shoes for their children. And that difference compounds year after year, which means at the end of their careers, they have less in their retirement accounts or less less money from Social Security. And that's a fundamental inequality that we need to fix.
There are critics of the ERA who would say there's already federal legislation that mandates equal pay for equal work. Why do we need a constitutional amendment?
Well, because what we know is that laws can be changed. And the Constitution, if we made it's a constitutional provision, it would send a signal that this is a basic tenet of American society, and I think it would just give us stronger standing in the courts to close that gap.
Because the gap is still there and it does exist, federal legislation notwithstanding. What kind of response have you gotten? Obviously, Democrats are in the minority at this moment, still in the General Assembly. What kind of response are you getting?
Well, I'm very proud to say that absolutely every Democrat in both the House and the Senate has signed on to be a co-sponsor to the ERA. That's, I think, the first time that that's happened. So I'm really proud of that accomplishment. However, we do need some Republican votes to get this ratified. And right now, it doesn't appear that we have those.
All right. Critics are saying that, in fact, it's too late to ratify the ERA. There have been two deadlines. A deadline has been extended for passage, according to the legislation that went along with Congress passing the ERA and sending it to the states. Deadline's passed. This won't count.
Well, that deadline was set by Congress, and Congress can amend that deadline. They did it once. They can do it again. And so I think our strategy is let's get it passed, and then Congress can amend the deadline, and we can move forward asserting that women are equal to men.
How do you think
what life, a concept.
You talked about the fact that equal pay and sort of economic justice, and of course that would have an economic impact for the whole state if that pay went up. Otherwise, how do you think life would change if the ERA were passed?
You know, I'm not sure it would actually change all that much. However, what we've been seeing in the last few years, as young women have stood up, I'm talking about the Me Too movement. I think we could also expect that women would be treated equally in our courts of law with respect to issues like domestic violence and sexual assault. I think women my age took some of that as just part of the cost of doing business. And I'm so proud of the young women who have stood up and said, no, that's not the way it should be. And We need to fix that. So women need the same protection in criminal courts as well. So, yeah, you're right, that there would be a change.
Terry Van Dyne is a Democratic state senator representing parts of Western North Carolina, including Buncombe County. And I want to bring in two different perspectives on the Equal Rights Amendment now. Joanna Wade is co-president of ERA NC Alliance. Joanna, welcome to you.
Thanks very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Sure. And Andrew Schlafly is a constitutional attorney for Phyllis Schlafly Eagles and the son of conservative activist and ERA opponent Phyllis Schlafly. Andy, welcome to you.
Thank you, Frank.
You just heard what Senator Van Dyne said about the importance, and she feels the need to pass an ERA. You're opposed. Why?
I'm opposed because there are certain differences we want to continue to recognize in the law and in funding programs that actually advantage women and recognize that women are sometimes victims. Women do not sometimes need to be pushed into the same roles that men are pushed into, such as the draft. And Senator Van Dyne mentioned the issue of domestic violence. That's an issue that particularly victimizes women. So there are a number of programs that are designed for women with respect to domestic violence. You see these shelters are generally women's shelters, and they're all about North Carolina, like every other state. They get funding for women's shelters for women to go to get protection from domestic violence. You can't do that if the Equal Rights Amendment is passed, because the Equal Rights Amendment requires equal treatment of men and women in all cases. So,
let me ask you one example. Okay, let me take that example and ask you, Joanna Wade, about that, co-president of the ERA NC Alliance, supporting the ERA. What about those differences? Many women, and they said it earlier when this debate was happening during the 70s, they would actually lose certain protections that they want.
So, thanks very much for raising the question, and I appreciate Mr. Schlafly's perspective and the opportunity to debate this a bit here on your show. First of all, I think that when people think about laws that protect women or are for women's benefits, lots of times those laws are actually gender neutral. So I don't know that the ERA and the ratification of the ERA would have the kind of dramatic consequence for those laws that opponents often suggest that they may. I also think it's untrue that state legislatures such as North Carolina's won't have the ability to pass laws that make distinctions on the basis of sex. I think you can still do that. Those distinctions would just be held to a higher level of scrutiny, the same level of scrutiny that's applied to distinctions based on race or national origin under the court's case law today.
What about, but in particular, do you think if you had funding for programs that go in particular to women, would that be jeopardized? How could you defend that if you say, you know, there must be equal treatment under the law? Joanna?
Yeah, I don't think that it will eliminate that necessarily. I think that the courts have allowed, race-based distinctions in certain cases that have remedial benefits to stand, and I don't think that that would eliminate assistance for women under the court's jurisprudence today.
Andy Schlafly, there's another objection, I understand, to the ratification, which is that you would say the deadline has expired. Tell us more about that.
Yes, Frank, there was a deadline, two deadlines, actually, first in 1979 and then in 1982. And this was issue of ERA was debated with the understanding that those deadlines would be in effect, and states passed or didn't pass ERA with those rules. Now, here we are, 40 years after the 1979 deadline, and the suggestion that that deadline can be ignored and that states can pass it today and tack on to the states that passed in the 70s, I mean, that would be like, Frank, trying to replay a high school football game that we played 40 years ago and say we're going to put more time on the clock and see if we can get a different result. It just violates all standards of fair play and the way that our legal process works. And I personally don't think any appellate court would consider a passage of the ERA today and tack that on to passage in the 70s when there was that very clear deadline for ratification.
Joanna Wade, what about that?
Sure, yeah. So just to be clear, Article 5 of the Constitution, which sets forth the parameters for ratifying an amendment to the Constitution, doesn't contain any deadline or impose a deadline. The deadline that we're talking about here is one that was set by Congress. Congress had the power to set it. Congress had the power to modify it, as it did in 1982. And Congress has that power to do that again. And in fact, there's been legislation introduced, bipartisan legislation, in both the House and the Senate to do that. And there'll be a hearing, I think, on the congressional bill in the next few weeks. So it is not the case that the deadline has expired such that the 38th ratification, the 37th, the 36th won't count. They do count. And Congress, of course, has the power to modify that deadline. I'd also just note that the last amendment to the U.S. Constitution, I believe the 27th, took some 200 years between the time it was submitted and actually completed. So the notion that, you know, it may take time, it may be long overdue from my perspective, but it's not too late.
Joanna Wade is co-president of ERANC Alliance. Andy Schlafly is a constitutional attorney for Phyllis Schlafly Eagles. And we will continue our conversation with them. We also heard from Senator Terry Van Dyne, who's a Democratic state senator who represents District 49, including Buncombe County. And our conversation will continue on the Equal Rights Amendment in North Carolina. We'll talk about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, talking about the Equal Rights Amendment, proposed constitutional amendment that would guarantee equal rights under the law regardless of sex. There's legislation in North Carolina to approve the ERA. The state could be the 38th to ratify the amendment, and that could meet the threshold for the ERA to become part of the U.S. Constitution. We're getting two different perspectives on the ERA now. Joanna Wade is co-president of the ERANC Alliance, and Andy Schlafly is the constitutional attorney for Phyllis Schlafly Eagles and also the son of conservative activist and ERA opponent Phyllis Schlafly. Joanna, let me ask you the bedrock question. Why do we need the Equal Rights Amendment?
Well, we need the Equal Rights Amendment because there's nothing in the Constitution that provides for constitutional equality between men and women. It just doesn't exist. And so with 24 simple words, we would write into the Constitution the provision that equality of the rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. The ERA would fill a gap that's lacking in the Constitution and in the decisions that interpret it, and would also enshrine this principle of constitutional equality in the Constitution itself, this core document that sets forth, ideas and foundational principles that we hold as a nation.
Well, tell us more about that gap, because there are those who would argue that the 14th Amendment already guarantees the rights that you've just spelled out.
People do argue that, for sure, and I'm glad that we're having the chance to talk about it here on the program today. So it's true that the 14th Amendment, and specifically its Equal Protection Clause, has been interpreted to provide some protection against gender-based discrimination. But there are limitations to that. Conservative Justice, the late Antonin Scalia, for example, is a jurist who believed that even those decisions were wrongly decided, because at the time the 14th Amendment was ratified, protection against gender discrimination was not what the framers were considering. In fact, women wouldn't have the right to vote even for many years. And so there are some jurists who believe that even the protection that's afforded against gender discrimination under the 14th Amendment, that those decisions are wrongly decided. And even if you follow that case law, the test that judges apply is one called intermediate scrutiny. So it's an intermediate level of scrutiny applied to instances of gender discrimination, and that's a lower level of scrutiny than what courts apply when they're considering distinctions on the basis of race or national origin. So there's a lower test that you have to satisfy if a law draws a distinction on the basis of gender.
Andy, let's talk about some of the other arguments that I've seen. I know that you have argued that the ERA would lead to taxpayer-funded abortions. Why?
Yes. Without the ERA in the Constitution, the Supreme Court held by a margin of only 5-4 in Harris v. McRae that taxpayers do not have to fund abortion. But that's the thinnest of margins. And if ERA became part of the Constitution, then almost certainly courts would then say that women have a right to funding for what they call health care, what the pro-abortion crowd calls health care, that women have a right to that because they have equal rights, and therefore women would have a constitutional right to taxpayer-funded abortion. Planned Parenthood would have a constitutional right to taxpayer-funded abortion, and we oppose that. And most Americans oppose taxpayer-funding abortion in particular, requiring taxpayers to fund abortion. So that would be an important and distressing consequence of passing ERA. I want to just mention one other thing, Frank. Sports is another sort of practical consequence of ERA that the proponents never talk about. But in Massachusetts, where they have a state ERA, boys are allowed to compete on girls' sports, and they do. And they go into girls' field hockey, they go into girls' swimming, and so on, and boys compete and win those events in girls' sports. And that's another example of how if you have a law that says no distinctions can be made between men and women and boys and girls, you're going to have these terrible results.
Joanna, let's take those one at a time and start with abortion.
Sure, yeah. So the ERA isn't all about changing the law on abortion. The Supreme Court's already recognized that the Constitution protects the right to abortion. That happened in Roe v. Wade and cases that have followed it. And Mr. Schlafly mentioned the case of states with state ERAs, and there are a number of them that have them. North Carolina isn't one, but there are states that have their own equal rights amendments to their state constitutions. And we've not seen meaningful changes in the laws on abortion in those states. I'm not aware of those states requiring taxpayer-funded abortions. I just don't think that's the case, and I don't think that ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment would lead to some of the extreme examples that opponents cite. With respect to sports, again, I can look into the example of Massachusetts, but I'm not aware of these other states outlawing different sports teams for men and women. And I played field hockey for Asheville High School. I was the captain of our field hockey team. And if a guy wanted to come and play on our team, I wouldn't have had a problem with that.
But let me ask you this, because it does seem like that it would set the stage for a court suit if someone wanted to play, a male wanted to play on female sports. There's the possibility that at this moment, males would then dominate sports and women might be pushed out. Could that not be the case? That would open the way for that kind of a challenge.
I think that those kinds of debates are already happening in the context of Title IX. And so I think there may be disagreements about those issues that are happening today, totally separate and apart from the Equal Rights Amendment. I don't think it's going to lead to those sort of extreme results. We've certainly not seen that happen in the states that have state ERAs.
Well, what about, Andy, you've talked about the fact that the ERA would change the balance of power between state and federal, the state-federal power balance. What do you mean by that?
Yes, ERA would transfer authority to the federal government over many family law-related issues that are currently handled exclusively by the states. So issues of marriage, child custody, divorce, all sorts of those sort of local issues that state legislatures currently have exclusive control over, that can all transfer to Congress under ERA, because ERA gives Congress the power to enact legislation with respect to differences between men and women and how those are handled. So there would be a huge transfer in power from local control over these gender issues to federal control in D.C. And frankly, people on both sides of the political spectrum are not happy with how Congress is getting the job done or not getting the job done. And do we really want to give Congress more power over these very local issues?
Well, let's take it one at a time. First of all, would it do that? Joanna, does the ERA do that, shift the power balance to the federal government over family matters?
No, it doesn't. It's true that the provisions of the Equal Rights Amendment include the one that I discussed at the beginning of this segment, that equality of the rights won't be denied on the basis of sex, and it does give Congress the power to enforce by appropriate legislation that first provision. But Congress has lots of power today to regulate many aspects of our personal and commercial lives. And I don't think that the legislative authority that the Equal Rights Amendment contains would transfer power to the federal government for things that the state government is doing. It's true that, state laws would be subject to scrutiny in the courts just like they are today under the Equal Rights Amendment, and might be held to a higher standard of strict scrutiny if they're drawing distinctions on the basis of sex. That doesn't mean that states can't make those laws. They just have to make sense, and they have to pass the appropriate test, the same test that we have for laws that draw distinctions on the basis of race or national origin.
I want to thank both of you for talking with us today. Joanna Wade is co-president of ERA-NC Alliance. Andy Schlafly is constitutional attorney for Phyllis Schlafly Eagles. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you, Frank.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, the debate over Equal Rights Amendment is active today, but the legislation has roots that are almost a century old. The amendment has a history that's tangled in the labor movement, the civil rights movement, and the women's liberation movement. Angela Robbins is here to tell us more. She's a professor of history at Meredith College. Angela, welcome.
Thank you, Frank. It's really nice to be here.
When did this debate, this question, really begin?
Well, it really begins right after women gain the right to vote with the 19th Amendment. Alice Paul was prominent in the suffrage movement. Once women gain the right to vote, very many women start saying, okay, what's next? What do we tackle next? The right to vote gave women a degree of political equality, but there were many, many areas of life where women still did not have equality with men. And she wanted to tackle that with the Equal Rights Amendment.
And that's interesting. What were those areas? How did things look different? Because you might argue that now that you have the right to vote, let's take those on one at a time in your state and local legislature. You don't need an amendment.
That's right. And boy, what a slow process that would be, right? So I think that was part of her logic. And I think a really interesting way to sort of enter that discussion is to think about the people who opposed the Equal Rights Amendment then, because there were a lot of women who opposed it. And the reason they opposed it is because there were many women who were labor activists who had been fighting for a long time for protection under the law for women. So in other words, a different status for women workers than men. Definitely not equality, right? And they had gained those protective labor legislations. And they said to Alice Paul and other women who supported the Equal Rights Amendment, we're going to lose those protections. Women will no longer have those. Now, that's a big deal in the 1920s and the 1930s before New Deal legislation. FDR comes along and he says, no, we need minimum wage, maximum hours for all workers. This starts to become the discussion now. And the Supreme Court goes along with that beginning in the 1930s. Prior to the 1930s, the Supreme Court supported business practices. They were reluctant to try to tell business owners how to run their businesses. So they did not support labor protections. They did not support unions, that sort of thing. So by the 1930s, the discussion starts to change. And by 1940, you have the Republican Party adding the ERA to its platform.
The Republican Party.
And saying, we support this.
Yeah. Yes. And why? What was the rationale there?
Both parties supported the Equal Rights Amendment.
50% of the voters were women, so why not at that moment, right? But the dynamics are interesting. You already pointed to one of the interesting dynamics that's going to follow this debate all the way through the century and into the 21st, which is not all women are for it. There is a sense of a protected status that we may want to keep. You also point to the fact that it suggests that women had some leverage in the workplace if they could get these things enacted, right? These changes made by the early 1930s, there was some leverage. So the dynamics ebb and flow in fascinating ways.
They definitely do. And you have more people, more entities, if you will, paying attention to these issues. So, for example, by 1961, President JFK has started a commission on women. And one of the things that he's looking at is labor conditions for women, equal pay. We get the Equal Pay Act in 1963 out of this. So there's a lot of discussion leading up to when Congress actually passes the ERA. A lot of liberal legislation has already been put in place that makes it feel like, okay, the ERA is something whose time has come.
So talk about that movement and the second movement now in the 1970s. Where did that come from?
So after several years of not having, certainly not having enough support in Congress to pass, it finally does pass in 1972. Then it goes to the states for ratification. But preceding this 1972 approval of the ERA, we had the Equal Rights Amendment. We had the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which said you cannot discriminate against a woman in the workplace, right? There will be no discrimination on the basis of sex. We had Title IX in the same year that the ERA was approved in Congress. So again, all of these liberal legislations that are passing, it looks like, yes, people support this. All the polls say that Americans broadly support the Equal Rights Amendment. And many of the activists that we've interviewed for the North Carolina Women's Oral History Collection said, yeah, who would be opposed to this, right? Who in 1972 would be opposed to another liberal reform?
And they weren't. And 35 states very quickly fall in line and approve it. It looks right. Like it's, and then all of a sudden, it just, the door slammed shut. What happened?
All of a sudden. Well, a powerhouse named Phyllis Schlafly is a big part of the explanation. And she definitely had resources behind her. She had a powerful message. She was able to round up women in North Carolina, women all over the country, to come together in opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment for some of the very reasons your previous guest discussed. Why would people be opposed to this? That started to become the discussion.
We talked about that oral history project. Gladys Graves is one of the women who contributed to that and talked about why she thought things came to a halt.
I think that the two main things were, one, the Christian, the religious organizations had a better campaign. Mm-hmm. They had a better campaign. They went to an area for support that I think traditionally we had not included churches as a part of the plan to support these issues. But the churches became a vehicle to get the message out about why they should not do it. Then the other one was, you know, we're still talking the 70s, we're trying to come out of the Jim Crow era into more human and civil rights. And the people who were in power, that they didn't see themselves as being advocates for equality for women.
That's a clip of Gladys Graves, part of an oral history project in collaboration between the Women's Forum of North Carolina and Meredith College. And I'm talking to Meredith College history professor Angela Robbins about the ERA. Talked about Phyllis Schlafly. Another key character in this was a guy named Jesse Helms.
Yes, absolutely. So Jesse Helms, as far as many Republican women in North Carolina were concerned, was breaking with the Republican Party when he decided to oppose the ERA. He's creating, along with Phyllis Schlafly and other North Carolina women who opposed it, a sort of template for this new conservatism that's really very well represented by Ronald Reagan's 1980 campaign. I mentioned before, the Republican Party put the ERA on their platform in 1940. They supported it all the way up to 1980. They removed it in 1980. That tells you a lot.
And of course, Jesse Helms is the guy who figured out how you can use culture wars and cultural distinctions to grab essentially minority power, right? If you're
Absolutely.
Starting to slip with the majority, you can create these culture wars, and was very successful at it, including the March of Rural Women who came to the North Carolina legislature. Talk
right.
about that.
Yes, the women we interviewed from the Women's Forum, talked about these women from rural areas, conservative women. You know, Gladys Graves is mentioning church women. She's really talking about folks who are determined to hold on to tradition, who have conservative viewpoints on a lot of issues. And they showed up in droves, as one of the interviewees said, quite by surprise. or at least the supporters of ERA were taken quite by surprise to see all of these women show up. They baked bread and baked pies and came in with a very different message that probably confused a lot of the legislators. Here are legislators who had been talking to ERA supporters for a while. They had heard the logic behind the ERA supporters' message, and now they were getting women coming at them with a very different message. And so it was stopping some of them dead in their tracks to say, well, I thought women wanted this. Now I'm hearing that women don't want this. And it created a really interesting situation where some men who had decided they were going to vote for it were now deciding they weren't going to vote for it, and some of them were reluctant to share that with the ERA supporters. But that's, in the end, what happened.
Very, very briefly now, I have seconds left in this Me Too moment. What do you think about the chances of the ERA?
I think that we're probably still not quite there. This is something that we hear over and over again in the interviews. Women who have decades of experience in this movement, watching the legislature and how it works, and seeing the current legislature in North Carolina likely way too conservative to actually support this at this time.
Angela Robbins is a professor of history at Meredith College. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Just ahead, a documentary that shows citizen systematic ways of voter suppression by the North Carolina Republican General Assembly here in our state. We'll take a look at that documentary in just a moment. Stay tuned.